morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Several Ugandan opposition politicians form a new pressure group.
Poverty is the immense crisis and growing by the day. We must all stand up and confront the crisis.
Guinean politicians discuss transitional parliament participation as the military junta chooses a new prime minister. South Sudan freezes the bank accounts of last August aborted protest organizers. One man's solution to help and feed inner-city South Africans. And the UN says transitional justice is key to unlocking the cycle of violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Transitional justice is key to unlocking the vicious circle of violence that persists in the DRC. The establishment of transitional justice mechanisms needs to effectively address impunity.
And the Sao Paulo Declaration and the indigenous people of Chad. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A section of Ugandan opposition politicians announced on Thursday a new pressure group called People's Front for Transition, or PFT, to be headed by four-time presidential candidate and retired Colonel Dr. Chisa Besigye. The group says it will mobilize Ugandans to remove the current government before 2026. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakarinji has more from Kampala.
While launching the new loose coalition, comprising of several opposition parties, retired Colonel Chisa Besigye blamed President Yoweri Museveni's government for not investing in education and health. He said the lack of these has exacerbated the COVID-19 pandemic.
Poverty is an immense crisis and growing by the day. We must all stand up and confront the crisis. So there is a crisis in the country that we must face, and face urgently, and face head on, and not withdraw until it is done. We must.
Peter Warubiri, the president of Uganda People's Congress, UPC, one of the oldest parties in the country, outlined what he said is the task that must be accomplished for the new coalition's success.
Undivided commitment to the aims and objectives of the front. Two, action which speaks louder than the words we shall utter and we are uttering today. It requires sacrifice. It requires to banish fear.
Henry Chams, leader of Conservative Party Uganda, says one of the reasons his party decided to join the coalition is to fight what he termed bad laws, including President Museveni's recent stance to remove bail.
The application for bail is a global right. And when you ban it, abolish it, you encroach on the Universal Charter for Human Rights, to which Uganda is a member in New York City.
Patrick Oboi Amuriat, the president of the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, described the launch as the beginning of a difficult journey.
We are going to go through imprisonment and confinement. We are going to go through the harassment that many of you have gone through before, and they began today by trying to intimidate us. The message to the dictator is that that kind of intimidation he has attempted several times will not work.
The political activists promised that they will, in 3 weeks' time, announce how they will execute their plan. They also called on Uganda's largest opposition party in the parliament, the National Platform, which is headed by former presidential candidate Robert Chagurani, popularly known as Bobi Wine, to also join in. It is not the first time that opposition leaders have come together under the umbrella of a pressure group. Ugandans will be watching how the group will implement their plan, but most especially how Uganda's security forces will react. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
A report by UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet finds some progress has been made in the human rights situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo. However, the report says extensive violations and abuses continue unabated in North Kivu and Ituri provinces. As Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, Bachelet is calling for a system of what the UN calls transitional justice to address the situation.
The report says the total number of human rights violations and abuses in eastern Congo dropped slightly during the period between June 1, 2020 and May 31, 2021, compared to the year before. Despite this decrease, it says the number of people killed in summary and extrajudicial executions rose to more than 600. That includes nearly 400 people killed by a rebel group in Ituri province and 236 people killed by members of the Congolese security and defense forces in the provinces of Ituri and North Kivu. UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights Nada Al-Nashif, who presented the report to the UN Human Rights Council this week, said violations by Congolese armed forces continue to pose serious concerns.
These violations undermine efforts deployed to secure the east of the country. I urge the government to take the necessary measures to ensure that military operations of the armed forces against armed groups are conducted in strict compliance with human rights and international humanitarian law, and that violations by any members of the security forces are investigated and prosecuted promptly in accordance with the right to fair trial standards.
During the reporting period, Al-Nashif said Congolese courts have convicted nearly 300 members of the DRC Armed Forces, Congolese National Police, as well as members of armed groups on various charges. Some were found guilty of crimes against humanity and war crimes. She says it is critical that the DRC implement a system of transitional justice so perpetrators of violations and abuses continue to be prosecuted.
As the High Commissioner has stated during previous session of the Human Rights Council, transitional justice is key to unblocking the vicious circle of violence that persists in the DRC. The establishment of transitional justice mechanisms needs to effectively address impunity, guarantee access to justice and redress for victims, and ensure the implementation of guarantees of non-repetition.
Transitional justice is a strategy, a way for countries emerging from conflict and repression to deal with human rights violations that are too large for a normal system of justice to tackle. It can include setting up special courts to prosecute gross human rights violations, reforming the existing justice system, or establishing a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. UN Human Rights Spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani told VOA that the UN cannot prescribe what form transitional justice should take in the DRC. This, she says, depends on what the victims and civil society in the country demand. DRC Minister for Human Rights Albert Fabrice Puella says his government is determined to set up a national commission for transitional justice and create a national reparation fund for victims of serious crimes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Sudan's government has frozen the bank accounts of four top South Sudanese civil society activists and one senior government official for their connection to an aborted anti-government protest. In August this year, a coalition of civil society group calling itself the People's Coalition for Civil Action, or the PCCA, called for a mass nationwide protest to demand the resignation of President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar for what they call their failure to run the country. As Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba, the government has also ordered commercial banks to freeze the accounts of four organizations that the activists used to work for in South Sudan.
In a statement released Wednesday this week, the South Sudan Central Bank called on banks throughout the country to freeze the accounts of the PCCA leaders. The document dated October 6, 2021, is signed by Moses Makur Deng, Director General for Banking Supervision, Research and Statistics at the Central Bank. It reads in part, quote, "You are hereby directed to freeze and block all the bank accounts of the below individuals with immediate effect, end of quote. The activists named in the documents include Abraham A. Awolich, Rajab Mohandis, Wani Michael Saki, Jame David Kolok, and Kwel Aguer Kwel, who is a former senior government official. Chance Baniko, the communications officer at the South Sudan Central Bank, says he is not authorized to speak and refused to be interviewed on this story. However, he confirmed in a text message to journalists saying, quote, "The document freezing the bank accounts of persons mentioned therein is authentic," end of quote. Some rights activists have condemned the government's move, saying it is illegal and an attempt to silence the voices of citizens and critics who are pointing out weaknesses of the government. Human rights lawyer Philip Anyang says he is shocked by the government's action.
It's sending a very bad message. It's sending a signal that we're not exactly following up the process of the law. If anyone is suspected of having committed a crime or an offense, the due process of the law should have been undertaken and such person forced to face the law.
The government has also ordered commercial banks in South Sudan to freeze the accounts of four organizations the activists used to work for in South Sudan. They include the Sud Institute, Organization for Responsive Governance, OK Africa Foundation, and a Foundation for Democracy and Accountable Governance. Rights activist Abdallah says the move highlights how intolerant the government is about the work of rights activists in the country, adding that the latest action brings public trust into question.
They have the powers to suppress the work of civil society organizations in the country and also to tell South Sudanese to keep quiet regarding what is good or what is bad going on in this country.
In early August this year, the PCCA issued a declaration saying they had had enough after 10 years of South Sudan independence marked by armed conflict, escalating insecurity, hunger, and political instability. On 30th August, PCCA leaders announced to hold a peaceful public uprising to demand political change, but the plan was aborted after the government deployed heavily armed troops in the capital, Juba. So far, most PCCA leaders have gone into hiding and others fled the country. Kwel Aguer Kwel was, however, arrested and detained by the government. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 8th. With the COVID-19 pandemic, South Africa has seen hunger increase nearly threefold, according to a national survey. One man is helping to tackle the problem by launching community farms that inner-city residents can use to feed themselves and their families. Linda Giftage reports from Johannesburg.
Between flower beds, along roadsides, and on school fields, crops are springing up around South Africa's largest city. The idea for these so-called edible streets was initiated by Siyabonga Nkandlamandla and the nonprofit, the Makers Valley Partnership, to curb hunger and malnutrition. Nkandlamandla says the need has become ever more apparent as gardens were picked bare when lockdowns were imposed last year.
You could see that this household haven't had a meal in the past 2 days or so. Then others will open up their fridge, refrigerator for you, or others will open up their cupboard. You could see that there's literally nothing.
South Africa is a major producer and exporter of fresh food, but many in the country aren't able to fill their plates. A national survey led by South Africa's Research Council found that as many as 22% of the country's 60 million people have experienced hunger since the pandemic struck. That's compared to just 6% pre-pandemic. Professor Lisa Corsten specializes in food security at the University of Pretoria.
It's about inequalities and ineffective access to food in the different regions of the country. People not only lost their jobs, they didn't have access to food.
About 100 people benefit monthly from the food being produced on one urban farm in East Johannesburg. An open kitchen is also available at the site to anyone in the community. Farmer Nkosinati Tango says growing vegetables at home and in communities is one solution to secure nutritious food.
So we've seen a lot of people coming through and with the willingness of also working in the land because they see the results that they're going to eat at the end of the day.
With food prices having spiked nearly 7% this year, according to the government, these projects have become crucial to many. That's why Nkandlamandla wants to inspire more people to grow food.
If this can be replicated all over the province, it could actually be part of the solution to end this food crisis that we have in this country.
Waiting for seeds to sprout is no quick fix. But with more funding, Makers Valley wants to plant more vegetable patches throughout Johannesburg to help put more greens on people's plates. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Political parties in Guinea have met to discuss their participation in a soon-to-be-named transitional parliament. The group is also awaiting word from the military junta about who will serve in the transitional parliament. This comes as transitional president Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya on Wednesday appointed Mohamed Bivogi as the new transitional prime minister. Bivogi promised on Thursday to carry out his new role with honor and dignity. Faya Milimuno, the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party, says most Guineans view the new prime minister as someone who will be even-handed when it comes to preparing the country for democratic rule.
The new prime minister appointed by the junta, his name is Mr. Mohamed Behagogi. Recently, he used to work for the United Nations, a person everybody recognized having a lot of knowledge and very skilled, and the person with a lot of experience, especially at the international level. More importantly, a person everybody can consider as being neutral when we consider the political arena of Guinea. He is the nephew of Diallo Tele.
What is next for the junta?
What is next for the junta is to wait for the new prime minister to put together the cabinet and put the proposal on the table.
Talking about cabinet, do the political parties want to be part of the cabinet?
At this time, nobody knows what is going to be the situation when we consider the participation of the political parties. In the legislative body of the transition, it is clear that political parties will be represented by 15 of their members. But for the government, in the bylaw of this transitional period, nothing is said. So we are waiting to see what direction they will take in that composition of the cabinet.
Of course, you know that the ECOWAS wants this transition at least 6 months to get it done. It seems to be falling behind already.
Well, we have here the ECOWAS leaders have said, but they know themselves that there is no country, even in the normal time in Africa, that can organize an election in 6 months, even in 1 year. So if it is not a way of putting together all the conditions to see another coup d'etat in the near future, we need to take the time necessarily to succeed this transitional period. It's not the first time Guinea has experienced the transitional period. We got it in 1984 and also in 2008. And today, we are still talking about writing the new constitution. So it means that everybody should do his part, including ECOWAS, including the United Nations, so that Guinea can be out of that instability before going to those elections.
Faya Milimuno is the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. You are speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. The Sao Paulo Declaration on Planetary Health, launched this week, suggests concrete actions so that humans make transformational shifts on how to improve the health and well-being of all people and the planet. The group highlights the voices and expertise of indigenous communities. One signatory to the agreement is Hindu Umaru Ibrahim, president of the Association for Indigenous Women and Peoples of Chad. She tells Ricky Stryer the declaration is a great initiative because it calls on people from different sectors to come together for a green transition.
We cannot talk about food without talking about the sustainable environment. We cannot talk about health without talking about the sustainable environment. In my community, I know exactly how it works. We never divided our human health and our environment health because we know that nature is giving us food, medicine, water, clean air, and everything that we need. We can take it from the nature. We are not relying to any business that can sell it for us.
There are so many lessons to be learned, especially from Indigenous communities and even more so from Indigenous women, in my experience anyway. But the same systems that have meant that we have not listened to Indigenous women for so long are still in place. So how do we reconcile this systems that are in place in terms of government systems, in terms of economic systems that have for so long not just ignored but oppressed Indigenous women? How do we reconcile still living in those systems while listening and building a different system?
Yeah, that's true. We have been ignored for so long and even depressed by all the systems from the government to the companies, ignoring the Indigenous people's way of living, even just to considering us as a primary peoples who are not the new world or in the new civilization that as they are calling it. And that have been so effective to the Indigenous women more, even because when you grow up, you have to pass it through all the generation how much you are so discriminated by other peoples. However, we saw the features are showing us the Indigenous people's way of living is the most sustainable one.
Hindu Umaru Ibrahim, the president of the Association for Indigenous Women and Peoples of Chad. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Paris. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with a wrap of Thursday's matches in the Africa's 2022 World Cup qualifying. In Morocco, Ibrahim Akone was the toast of the Malian side as he scored a hat-trick and laid out one assist as the Malians soared over Harambee Stars of Kenya with an affirming 5-0 victory in Agadir in their third qualification match for the Qatar 2022 FIFA World Cup. Mali remains unbeaten in Group E and now move top with 7 points, with the fourth round of matches scheduled for Sunday. Kenya dropped to third with 2 points and now must win the return tie in Nairobi to get themselves back into contention. Meanwhile, in raids, Tunisia kept their 100% record in Group B with an assured performance, beating Mauritania 3-0 to move to 9 points. The upset in Thursday's matches was recorded in Lagos, Nigeria, where substitute Karl Namaganda scored a sensational 90th-minute goal as the Central African Republic stunned Nigeria's Super Eagles at home, beating them by a lone goal in their third Qatar 2022 FIFA World Cup qualifier. Despite that result, Nigeria remains top of Group C with 6 points, while the Central African Republic climbs up to third with 4 points, same as second-place Cape Verde, who had earlier come from behind to beat Liberia 2-1. In Kigali, Uganda picked their maiden victory away in Group E after beating host Rwanda by a lone goal. Equatorial Guinea moved to second in Group B after beating 10-man Zambia 2-0. Saul Basilo Kokobasi Obina gave the home side the lead after 35 minutes, just 10 minutes after the Zambians were reduced to 10 men. In other results, Benin moved top of Group J in the Qatar 2022 FIFA World Cup qualifiers after a precious 1-0 win away to Tanzania at the Benjamin Mkapa Stadium in Dar es Salaam on Thursday evening. At the Stade de Martyrs in Kinshasa, goals from Chadrak Akolo and skipper Dumerksi Mbokani gave the DR Congo side a 2-0 victory over Madagascar to move second in the group with 5 points. Away from the 2022 FIFA World Cup qualifying, but staying with football news, Gor Mahia, Kenya's top club side, have received another transfer ban from world governing body FIFA over its failure to settle a $27,000 owed to Ghanaian midfielder Jackson Owusu. This comes a few weeks after the club was cleared to sign new players after settling money owed to former coach Stephen Pollock and Tanzanian winger Dixon Ambudu.
FIFA had imposed a two-window transfer ban on the club over its failure to pay the draw. The new ban comes at a time when the club is preparing for its CAF Confederations Cup second-round tie against Akli Merue of Sudan next Friday. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, October 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.